It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh region could be short by 80,000 workers by 2025, based just on retirements with too little talent already in the pipeline. What are our leaders doing to meet the demand? Earl Buford is the CEO of Partner for Work, the local workforce development organization. Earl, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin, and good morning, everyone.
All right, we're going to start off, before we get into the challenges and the opportunities this region has. People have heard this. They've heard Partner for Work under its previous name, Three Rivers Workforce Investment Board. What does a workforce investment board do?
I'm glad you asked that because I'm often asked that question. First of all, there are about 800 workforce boards across the country and 22 in the state of Pennsylvania. So workforce boards are basically the statutory legislative designated workforce arm for a certain area. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, Allegheny County and City of Pittsburgh is our designated workforce area. We're responsible for the federal funds that come into that area and how we dispense those funds. For instance, we have kind of four buckets of funding. Mm-hmm. Youth in school, youth out of school, adult program, which we can talk about later, right, and dislocated worker programming.
Okay. So what are some of the factors that are impacting that shortage that I mentioned just a moment ago? Is it more than just little or no population growth in this area? So what are the factors when it comes to shortage?
That's definitely a factor. Mm-hmm. There's also a disconnect between the skills mismatch, but that's not the only thing. There's also, underabundance of programming within in-school programming in school districts. There's also just a lack of comprehension on the job seekers on what's really out there. And then, of course, on the industry side, what do they really want in some cases?
Those first three, do they all tie together? The schools, the lack of awareness of what's out there and what's needed, and the programming that would be required, the training required to meet the employer's needs. Do they all tie together to, in a sense, to meet that fourth thing that you mentioned, the employers?
I'm going to say all five. Let's say five or four. Whatever the number was, all tie together. Right. Everyone has a role in workforce development. I often say and think workforce development is really a response to economic development.
Okay.
And sometimes we do it backwards in this country, where it's about the people and the supply side, where we put a lot of programming together without input or guidance from business and industry. And so that's why I say we're a response, really. If we do it right, we're a response.
How far out do you need to look so that you, with the employer's needs, that can help you do your work in terms of telling the workforce currently and the future workers what might be available, what is needed?
It's a dual strategy. It's a short term and a long term. Short term is filling these job openings that are there now and putting people to work who are ready to go to work. Long term is preparing for the industries of the future. So you have to do both. The other thing I think we often do, and I've been guilty in my career, which I think we'll talk more about, is in that short-term fix, finding people for jobs that are available or right in front of you, in some cases matching their skills.
Right.
But we often forget a large segment of the population, people that are already working, that want a better job or want a better career pathway. We often neglect that population. I think it should be the other way around. We start with them, help them find the next path. That's what employers want, someone who can go to work every day and learn and grow, and then backfill with those openings when they leave those jobs.
What is the impact of college grads? I mean, Pittsburgh is known for some really great universities and colleges, but we lose a lot of those graduates. What is that impact on the workforce needs in terms of the availability?
So I'm going to answer it in two ways. It's humongous, but you're not the only city dealing with this. Coming from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, we were having the same conversation before I left. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if everyone's going to Seattle now or New York or L.A. or where everyone's going, but every mid-sized city or region is having the same conversation. That aside, Pittsburgh is dealing with that. And what can we do to do that? I know the conference right now, I sit on the workforce committee, and we're really, really digging into a large, more robust corporate internship program. That's not going to solve it all, but if you structure that better, especially focus on those graduating seniors and those college students, so they start to work and live here, and also us as employers, and I'm an employer as well, we start to understand the talent in front of us, and we do everything we can to keep them.
So sort of getting them to sink their roots a little bit deeper.
Yes, absolutely. And you gave me a term earlier, gum banding.
So get people to come back to
the area. Exactly. So I'm excited about that, about how to utilize that. I've learned so much now.
You've been here since June?
June 1st was my first day on the job, and my first day on the job was my first board meeting.
Well, that'll either get you excited or why did I take this job?
I was excited, still excited.
Okay. What have you learned during that time in terms of particular sectors that are crying for employees or projecting, hold it, what are we going to be doing in 2, 3, 7 years down the line?
Well, again, every industry says we have needs, and so I can't pick one or the other. So what we've focused on maybe 7 sectors. I'll try to name them off: financial services, construction, manufacturing, IT, healthcare, hospitality, and missing one somewhere in there. Transportation logistics.
There it is.
Oh, and public sector. What are our municipalities and their needs? We picked those sectors, one, because that's what's highlighted in our local economy, in the reports that we read and the research. But there's also the low-hanging fruit of employers from those industries and industry leaders. Let's not forget our labor friends and things like that. That said, we have needs to work with us now. And I love the fact that they stepped up and said, come to us. I mean, just yesterday there was a major announcement by the Builders Guild and the building trades.
Yep, we had Jeff Novers on the show.
Absolutely, my good friend. And we're a heavy investor in that initiative, a partner and investor. Mm-hmm. So we're really excited about that. The key to that is they approached me and said, we want to do things a little differently. We want to take on more ownership, and we want to guarantee jobs and apprenticeship at any of those training. Think about that. An industry-led initiative is going to make sure that there's a training program that leads to employment and apprenticeship. So years ago, President Obama used to mention the problems in workforce in this country. He always said the days of training and praying are over. Because that's how we've traditionally done workforce. Mm-hmm. Training program, then you beg employers to take your people. It doesn't work. You have to lead the other way.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is Earl Buford, the CEO of Partner for Work, the local workforce development organization. Earl, prior to coming to Pittsburgh last year, you were CEO of a similar organization, Employ Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. How has that experience affected your approach to what you want to accomplish here in the Pittsburgh area?
It shaped it greatly. So I ran the workforce board in Milwaukee for 4 years. Before that, I ran in basically a workforce association, a private association for the construction and manufacturing industries. So I give that background because it helped shape my outlook on how workforce should be done or can be done. That's really kind of a mantra.
Right.
Industry-led, worker-centered, but community-focused. You have to have that industry at the forefront, that response to economic development, but you also have to have an ability to connect to people, mm-hmm. people where they're at, so that the two will connect at some point, so that employers are looking for people, say, we have a way or a mechanism to find those people or find ways to put talent together. Flip side, you have to have job seekers in the community understanding how to access those situations. Whether they're ready or not, at least they have a better understanding. So that was the one thing that my previous employment on the private sector side taught me. But of course, taking on the public workforce system, there's a lot of rules and regs there for reasons. You're dealing with taxpayers' funding in a lot of cases. But in addition to that, you have to also understand that we are putting together these initiatives that will make sense. I mean, it sounds matter of fact sometimes or common sense, but it really is.
Right. I'm going to talk about those initiatives in terms of funding. A few minutes ago, you referenced the workforce development boards across the country,
yes.
and I think 22 in Pennsylvania. They use federal funds for job training programs. In your role, are you taking a look at how effective these funds are being used here?
Absolutely. Yes, in two ways. One, obviously, we monitor ourselves. We are monitored by state and federal government. But in addition to that, about three and a half years ago, I created a partnership, a membership-based consortium of workforce boards across a regional approach. So it was about 13 mostly urban workforce boards as far west as Wichita, Kansas, as far east as Pittsburgh, and then thinking between Chicago, Detroit, Minneapolis. Those are our partners in this association I created. Mm-hmm. And part of it is a community of practice. One, we get to say, okay, what are best practices that work in your area that we can replicate in other areas and scale. The other thing is we're able to raise other funding that can help our local areas create. For instance, we just received a few months back an $8 million dislocated worker grant from the Department of Labor, a regional Pittsburgh area grant. We're also working in conjunction with six of those 13 cities, Columbus, Indianapolis, give you some idea.
Right.
So the point is we have a vehicle to measure ourselves and also measure look at the measurements of the federal government across our respective areas. So I think we're a pretty nice practice of pulling that together and also what's our ROI on that.
Right. You mentioned sort of in the past maybe doing things a little backwards, if you would. So how can this region, how can Partner for Work and all the stakeholders that you work with trying to meet the challenge of workforce development, how can you be more creative in your approach?
Yeah, a few ways have come out. So coming on, I put together a transition committee of our board of directors and outside stakeholders to talk about the rules and responsibilities that we have, but also how can we be more innovative. The law that we're under is called the Workforce Innovation Opportunities Act. So that is what we're expected to do, be innovative with the funding and partnerships. So a couple things came out of that transition committee. One, connect better to business and industry. So we're in the process of creating advisory councils across those seven sectors I mentioned earlier. So think about employers or industry leaders advising us on how to develop training programs or how to fund initiatives like the Jeff Nobers initiative that was mentioned earlier. That's one strong way. So as a call to action, we're asking employers and other folks to get involved with us, helping us develop better systems for them and for the community at whole. So that's one big way we're important about. We're also working with philanthropy. Right now there's a major surge in this area for major philanthropic leaders to work together. A lot of us fund workforce in many different ways. Some of us fund it in very similar ways. But now we're talking to each other about how can we scale up things that are non-traditional or more innovative, whether it's more in-school programming or things like that.
Right. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking to Earl Buford, the CEO of Partner for Work. Earl, do you think that there's been a disconnect with industry sectors, maybe assuming what they need without actually talking to the experts themselves and finding out, here's what we need, and here's what we need in a future employee?
Yeah, that's probably gone on about 40 years in this country.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not mincing words. That's really the approach has been to train and pray. And it's a tough one because it's really... Workforce Board has two tools that are really useful. We can provide training dollars to employers or to training partners like a community college or a community-based organization. We can provide those funds. We also can provide a short-term wage subsidy. So if you think about the breakdown, many of the urban boards across the country, we do a lot of training. Most of our budget is around training because that's what we're told it's needed, but it's also a way to get money to our communities. But on-the-job training subsidy are used in smaller and more regional boards. So we're trying to use a more balanced approach to both of those funding sources. So if there's a smaller, medium-sized business that needs to bring on, let's say, 5 or 10 employers, but the OJT will kick in or the subsidy can help. But in some cases, training is needed. But back to your question, having that developed on the front end, I can't repeat that enough. We have to have that input or that guidance from business industry that says, this is what we want, this is what we're going to articulate, this is what we're going to accept.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I want to ask you what your plan is to engage the emerging industry groups, whether it's autonomous vehicles, robotics, additive manufacturing, to identify their workforce needs.
Right. So right now we're on the advanced manufacturing, additive manufacturing. We are developing that advisory council. So again, leaders of said industry explaining to us their immediate needs, but also their forecasted needs, and having us and others develop work with them to develop the response to that. So that's happening. As that develops and becomes more advanced, those conversations will advance into future technology and future needs and future recruitment. All those things will come together. But it's really important that we continue to recruit and develop these councils and that advisement.
In February, Governor Wolf signed an executive order creating a command center to more quickly address worker skills gaps and needs of employers. Can you tell yet whether this will help complement the work that you do?
Since it was just announced, we're still reading through it, not trying to articulate it and comprehend it. Right now, I'm positive about it. I think any focus on workforce is going to be a positive, especially if there's more resources brought to the table and more focus. Especially, I know hearing Governor Wolf and hearing him speak many times, he comes from the same idea of, you know, economic development, workforce coming together.
In a couple of sentences, so what's on your agenda for the remainder of 2019? What can you accomplish in the short term?
Well, in the short term, I was hoping today to not say I think I only did it two or three times, so that's a victory right there. that aside, just really understand the market better, understand the neighborhoods better. Understand the political landscape better so that, you know, we can be effective. I think I have enough experience from my past experiences to bring to this local area, but also Pittsburgh it, as our team likes to say. And so we're excited to do that.
Very good. Earl Buford is the CEO of Partner for Work. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Mick Stanelli. Still ahead on The Confluence, unemployment among military veterans across the nation reached a low in January, but that rate is much higher in southwestern Pennsylvania, traditionally a stronghold for veterans. We'll find out why. Mayor Peduto has signed an executive order outlining expectations for safely testing autonomous vehicles on city streets, but are the guidelines any good if there are no penalties for noncompliance? And political candidates in Pittsburgh began filing monthly campaign finance reports last week ahead of the May primary. But there are a few surprises. Get conversations, stories, and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
The Yardbirds released For Your Love on this day in 1965. Written by Graham Goldman, For Your Love is one of the most famous rock songs to feature the harpsichord, and it was the group's first charting single in the United States. Well, the success was too much for guitarist Eric Clapton, who left the band after its release, saying they'd gone too commercial. Clapton, who preferred the group's earlier hard-charging blues rock sound, was replaced by Jeff Beck, who was later replaced by Jimmy Page. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The unemployment rate nationwide for military veterans hit an 18-year low in January at 3.7%, a bit lower than the overall jobless rate of 4%. But in the Pittsburgh area, the jobless rate for veterans is 6.6%. We're going to discuss why the disparity and what's being done to increase opportunities for veterans with Jack Wagner. Jack is a former Pittsburgh Council President, former state senator, former Pennsylvania Auditor General. He's a Marine Corps veteran of the Vietnam War and is the current director of Pittsburgh Hires Veterans. Jack, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. Honored to be here.
Jack, I mentioned 6.6% unemployment rate in Allegheny County, much higher than even more than 2 full percentage points above the overall unemployment rate for this area. Do you have a grasp of why veterans are struggling to find jobs more than the average Pittsburgher?
Well, I think there's a number of factors. Number one, we have a higher concentration of veterans. Number two, we have some major reserve units here in the Pittsburgh region, the 316th Army Unit, the 171st Refueling Wing, the 9/11th at the Pittsburgh International Airport. 50% of our military today is reserve and National Guard. Mm-hmm. So I think a number of factors have played into it, and the fact that government does not do much at all to help veterans find jobs. I've often used the comparison that every veteran and the spouse of a veteran is guaranteed a burial spot, but not a job. And we teach veterans how to take off in terms of training them in the military, but we don't teach them well how to land
in civilian life
when they come back to civilian life.
I want to talk a little bit about that some of the points you just brought up, including the large concentration. Well, this is nothing new. I mean, southwestern Pennsylvania has had a high concentration of veterans for decades and decades. So wouldn't you think that area companies that have been in existence for a while here would be aware of that and maybe sensitive to providing opportunities for veterans?
Yes, but the perception of the average citizen is that government helps veterans find jobs. That's not the case. The Veterans Administration helps veterans who are disabled to get the training necessary that hopefully leads to a job. But in terms of the people who are not disabled, there's very little that's done beyond what's done for the common citizen. Veterans have certain needs. I mean, when a veteran's been in the military 4 years, 8 years, 10 years, they've lived a whole different life. And they bring a great skill set to the workforce. They're mission-oriented. They can work in a team environment. They bring a lot of soft skills that every employer is looking for. I think employers need to take a better and a harder look at hiring more veterans.
So is it being aware of how you can take that skill set and adapt it to your particular business from the employee?
Yes. Number one, most veterans are very punctual. Veterans can work in a varied workforce. Veterans are team players. Veterans understand the mission of an organization. They are great soft skills for any employer, no matter what the job may be. So I think it's a matter of employers better understanding what veterans bring to the table, and veterans having a greater awareness of how to match their skill sets to job opportunities. That's what Pittsburgh Hires Veterans does. And we really haven't got to that, but it's an organization that myself and several other people started about 3 years ago. We sit with every single veteran. We don't just work with them over the internet. We sit with them. We understand their skill set, what their best match for a job will be, what opportunities that are out there, and we try to get them in front of an employer for an interview. And generally, a veteran will sell themselves if they have a real-life interview with an employer.
So you work with the veterans in person, assessing skill set, work on other skills they might need in applying for a job. Right. Do you work at the other end? Do you work with employers? What's your message to them?
Absolutely. We have a good 200 to 300 employers that we have excellent communication with, that I can get on the phone and ask this employer to give a veteran that has applied for a job an interview. Generally speaking, we're successful in doing that, not all the time. But it's a matter of convincing the veteran that they are capable of doing this job that they're applying for, building some confidence level in them. Keep in mind, some have never applied for a job before. Some come out of high school and go straight into the military, or some come out of college and go into the military. So, again, some for 10 years, some for 20 years. The transitional assistance program that the military has does not do a good job of preparing veterans for civilian life.
Do you help them, in a sense, sell themselves, say, hey, you can do this, you can do that, you can do this. Now you have to show your potential employer that how that applies to that workplace.
Yes. Number one, many don't have good resumes. Some need help in networking. Some need help in interview skills. So all of those factors play a very important role in getting a job. If you don't have a good resume, you're not going to get – that's your ticket to an interview. And we find that many veterans have horrible resumes.
This Saturday, Pittsburgh Hires Veterans is partnering with Point Park University for a day-long event. Jack, what's the goal of that?
The goal there, first off, I have to compliment Steve Tanzilli, who's the dean of the Roland School of Business at Point Park. he and his team at Point Park University came up with this idea and asked Pittsburgh Hires veterans to partner with them. The whole idea is to get veterans there and to give them a spattering of many issues that are important to them when they leave the military. Just not veterans, but also spouses of veterans. Also exposing them to job opportunities. We'll have at least a dozen employers there. So they will have the opportunity to meet employers. Veterans and spouses of veterans can still enroll. They can call our phone number for Pittsburgh Hires Veterans, 412-388-0100. They can go to our website, pittsburghhiresveterans.org. They can also inquire through Point Park University.
Oh, just a couple of minutes left. So how vital are events like this in getting veterans out into the job force and in front of prospective employers?
They're very valuable. And again, my hat's off that Point Park University is doing this. They understand the issue of veterans finding employment and also other issues such as being financially prepared when you come out of the military, knowing how to manage your money. So Point Park is well suited to offer professional advice in those areas.
You mentioned military spouses. Is that do military spouses also sort of contact you at Pittsburgh Hires Veterans?
Yes, we help spouses of veterans find employment also. Some veterans are disabled and not capable of working, and certainly a spouse of a veteran who is capable of working, we want to help them. So there's a multitude of ways in which we can help veterans. Pittsburgh Hires Veterans is focused purely on helping veterans and spouses of veterans find jobs.
And my final question for you is, what, if any, role does government play? You mentioned it really doesn't play a role in getting a job. I mean, you were wounded in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You served in government for years and years in various capacities that I mentioned earlier. You can look at this issue of employment for veterans from both sides. Does it frustrate you, the government's lack of involvement?
Yes. And number one, government at all levels, federal, state, county, school districts, local governments, should put a priority on hiring veterans. And obviously the private sector and the nonprofit sector also.
Jack Wagner is a retired Marine, former elected official, and is now director of Pittsburgh Hires Veterans. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Kevin.
This Saturday, Point Park University and Pittsburgh Hires Veterans are hosting The Starting Point to a New Career for veterans and their spouses at Point Park University from 8:30 to 3:30. It's free and open to the public. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out more about Carole Kaye. According to the New York Times, she's performed on an estimated 10,000 recordings. But even though the bulk of her session work is playing the bass, Carole Kaye got her start playing the guitar. In 1957, she played acoustic on the Ritchie Valens hit La Bamba. Una poca de gracia, in the early 60s, she switched to playing bass. By the end of the decade, she was the most sought-after bassist in L.A., playing on recordings by The Supremes, The Beach Boys, Barbara Streisand, Ike and Tina Turner, Frank Zappa, Nancy Sinatra, and many, many more. Carole Kaye was also a member of the legendary Wrecking Crew, a group of L.A.-based session players, and she was featured in the 2008 documentary about the group. To hear full songs from all of our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to WYEP.org/women.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Mayor Bill Peduto issued an executive order yesterday outlining city expectations for the safe testing of self-driving vehicles in Pittsburgh and assigning responsibilities for the development of transparent reporting guidelines for companies participating in the research. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden was there for the signing of this work agreement. She joins us now. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Kevin.
Okay, who was there and what was agreed upon?
So is the mayor, Karina Riggs, the head of the department, the city's Department of Mobility and Transportation, and then also Argo AI, Aptiv, Uber, Carnegie Mellon University, Aurora Innovation, big players on the autonomous vehicle sector here in Pittsburgh.
Right. So we have the companies, we have one of the leading researchers,
yeah,
Carnegie Mellon University, and of course the government officials.
Yes.
You mentioned Uber was there, of course. Uber, of course, stopped its testing in Pittsburgh last year following a fatal accident in Arizona. Uber resumed some of the testing in December. Have the guidelines these companies are expected to adhere to, have they been drafted yet?
So what was signed by the mayor yesterday in his executive order is more of a broad outline of the guidelines that later, sometime this year, the Department of Mobility and Transportation will be creating. So there's a lot of room to see where what these guidelines will do, and I guess we'll have to wait and see.
All right. It seems like there is a lot of wait and see.
Yes.
But what if the company fails to follow the guidelines? Do we know?
Yeah, I asked Director of the Department of Mobility and Infrastructure, Karina Riggs, what would happen if companies follow through, if there's any sort of way to encourage compliance with these guidelines. And this is what she said to me about that.
We want to start with every good faith that the guidelines will be respected and followed. I suppose that at a later date we can evaluate what kinds of enforcement or penalties might be necessary, but that seems like the wrong way to start a relationship. Again, this is early on in the testing phases. This is not a technology that is ready for deployment or for broad public use. So in terms of guidelines around testing and developing a relationship that is open and shared, this seems the better tone to begin with.
All right. So she said open and shared relationship, not a good way to start a relationship by threatening penalties.
Yeah. So my sense of that is that there won't be any penalties to start with. But Riggs also said that she thought it was important to create this sort of framework now as more companies eventually move into Pittsburgh to do autonomous vehicle testing.
What, if anything, did the company say that were on hand, though?
They just said how happy they were to be in Pittsburgh and how important Pittsburgh is to autonomous vehicles. And they were very excited to work with the city.
All right. And there are a lot. I don't know if people, I mean, Uber gets so much attention.
Right.
I don't know if people recognize how many companies are really testing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot.
Okay. My final question for you here is, okay, so now there's this sort of handshake, but on paper with no consequences, gentleman's agreement between the city and these companies. Did they at least talk about what the next steps would be?
Well, to Director Riggs's credit, when I asked her about specifics of the guidelines that were signed to create more guidelines, she did have some concrete policy ideas. Like, for example, when it came to data collection, she was able to give me some specifics about what sorts of data would and would not be collected, specifically public safety and miles traveled. And she talked about how it's kind of complicated to balance what data would be public knowledge versus proprietary. So I'm excited to see what a more fleshed out version of these guidelines will be. I'm excited to see how the policy will affect this industry, but right now we don't know.
And did they put like a timetable on when they might be fleshed out?
No.
To be determined.
Continued.
All right, Sarah. Sarah Bowden is a reporter for WESA. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Political candidates in Pittsburgh began filing monthly campaign finance reports last week ahead of the May primary. There are already a few surprises and maybe even a few more questions. WESA's government and accountability editor Chris Potter joins us in studio. Welcome, as always, Chris.
Good to be here, as always.
All right. Filing campaign finance reports. What exactly are candidates supposed to do and by when?
So for many years, the state has required candidates for local office to file these things, and they're basically a breakdown of everybody who's contributed to you. And depending on how much money they gave you, you provide more or less information. If they give you $5,000, you just talk about who their employer was, what their job is. If they give you less than $50, you don't even bother listing their name. The state has had these laws in place for a long time, but for a local office, you really only report twice before the primary, once in January to kind of sum up what you did the year before. A lot of people don't even have that report because they weren't campaigning then. And the other report, the big one, comes less than 2 weeks before the primary. So a few years back, the city came up with its own reporting schedule to give people more timely information about where their support was coming from. And it breaks down all the money they got and what they spent it on.
So to clarify, the city requirements were in addition to what the state was already doing for years?
That's exactly right. And you still do have to file with the state. That's a matter of state law. You can't get around that.
All right. So these were the first reports you mentioned January for this election cycle. Any trends you're already seeing?
Yeah, so a couple of things. One is that in addition to the reporting requirements, the city did impose campaign finance limits. People don't realize this, but in Pennsylvania, I can write you a check if you're running for governor for $100,000 or $1 million or whatever. There's no limit in Pennsylvania. The city decided to impose some limits that are consistent with the limits at the federal level. And on that score, we can look at these and say it has sort of reduced the amount of influence any one donor can wield. There, for example, you take the Laborers Union, which has been a very prominent giver. They're basically limited to $5,000 per donation per election cycle. So they've kind of the rules have reduced that. On the other hand, if you were hoping that these new limits would sort of level the playing field and that incumbents wouldn't have as much of an advantage, that does not seem to be panning out. In a lot of these races, the incumbents are outracing these folks 10 to 1. I think if you look at the District 3 race, Bruce Krause represents the South Side and other neighborhoods, raised about $29,000 just in 1 month period alone. All three of his challengers combined raised less than a tenth of that. So there's still that disparity there.
Right. Okay. The surprises.
The surprises are kind of who didn't file. And the biggest surprise is Leon Ford, whose campaign for District 9 City Council got off to a big start, a lot of excitement when he launched in November. He has not filed a report at all, at least not as of the end of the day yesterday, and these were due on Friday. It's kind of unclear about how actively Mr. Ford is campaigning at this point. The other candidate who didn't file is Darlene Harris, somewhat less of a surprise. She herself has also not filed in her
All right, you say somewhat less of a surprise because this happened before, was it in 17 when she was running for mayor?
That's exactly right. 2017 was the first year these rules applied, and she said basically the campaign finance law is not legal, because the state has its rules, the city can't add requirements beyond state law, and so she's refusing to file these things.
All right, she's been on council for a while. Yeah. Was this passed while she was on council?
Yeah, she abstained from that vote, okay. But it was when she was on council.
What recourse is there for a candidate who doesn't file? Was Harris punished, if you would, in 17?
There was some talk that she would be fined. There are fines laid out in the city code. There's also a provision that says if you're an official and you have an outstanding fine because of an ethics violation, we can withhold your salary until you take care of that. There was a $1,000 fine, discussion of levying that. I am told by Ms. Harris's lawyer that she has not paid anything, and it's not clear what is going to happen this time around either. But I mean, clearly, I think if this is kind of an existential moment, if Darlene Harris doesn't pay a penalty for doing so, why would anybody else file at all?
Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Government and Accountability Team. Thanks as always, Chris.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, a new research effort in Pittsburgh into Alzheimer's. The dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine is leaving that post to open up a new lab to research Alzheimer's, which affects 1 in 10 Americans 65 and older. A conversation with Dr. Arthur Levine. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcast. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.